This morning I mentioned to one of the brothers that I've been struggling with some kind of mighty Texan microbe for the last 3 days, and last night didn't have much of a voice, and he thought you might get a short sermon today. I think the wish was father to the thought, but he may be right at that. We'll just see how we get on with this. This may be your lucky day, you never know. Well, Thanksgiving is over, and you're here replete and full of Thanksgiving turkey, I suppose. But I have to warn you, there are only 24 shopping days to Christmas. Now, the stores tell us that all the time, don't they? And they mean business, and they mean business. And business is the operative word, I suppose. Now, I learned one thing the other day, that your Christmas celebration is not quite like ours in England, because we have another day's holiday. The 26th of December is also a bank holiday in England, and it has a name that's not on your calendar, but it's on my diary. And on my diary, that's marked as Boxing Day. Now, that is an unfortunate title in some respects, because it can give entirely the wrong impression. When I was in West Africa, in Ghana, I discovered that the Ghanaians, imitating the English, were also celebrating Boxing Day. But they thought that in England it was Boxing Day, because on Boxing Day we had boxing matches. They really, and in Ghana they have boxing matches on the 26th of December because they believe that it's Boxing Day. Well, that's not the origin of the word. It's not the origin of the practice. I know that you don't have it here because I'm pretty sure that the Pilgrim Fathers didn't bring it over here for the simple reason that it didn't exist in their days. And in any case, you know, I doubt very seriously if the Pilgrim Fathers would have celebrated Christmas anyway. There was a time in England when it was forbidden by law to celebrate Christmas. And Boxing Day, like many other of the bits and pieces that we attach to the celebration of so-called Christmas today, is of Victorian origin. I don't know why I'm telling you this, but since I started, I may as well finish. Just one of those things, you see. Anyway, in the days of Queen Victoria, the household servants, the domestics, didn't get a holiday on Christmas Day because they had to take care of the needs of the family. And so on the next day, December 26th, it became customary for the master and the mistress to serve Christmas dinner, a delayed Christmas dinner, to the household servants. And at some point on that day, the servants would be lined up, and the master and the mistress would come along, and they would hand out boxes, Christmas boxes, that contained a gift. And consequently, the 26th of December, from the Victorian calendar, has been called Boxing Day ever since. But of course, it was the day on which the servants received their gifts, and I suppose we all like to receive gifts. But you know, there's a text that I want to bring to you this morning, for a short time anyway, which says, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Now that's a bit of a puzzle, you know, that text. I wonder how many of you know where it comes from. I wonder how many of you know who said it, and when it was said, under what circumstances. It has become proverbial, of course, as you very well know. Yeah, it's used in so many humorous ways, you know, the highwayman or the outlaw stops the stagecoach and he holds up the passengers and he asks for their goodies, their money and their jewelry and their watches. And then as they hand it over, he smiles sweetly at them and he says, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Or a picture I have in my mind, from the day when in England we were allowed to receive the cane at school. You know, there's the boy who's got into trouble is bending over, and as the headmaster's about to apply the cane to the seat of the trouble, he says sternly, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Well, where did it come from? Is it just a proverb? Is it one of the wise sayings of Solomon? Is it a quotation from Shakespeare? Is it one of those Confucius said things that everybody seems to know? Where does it come from? Well, it may surprise you that these are the words of the Lord Jesus. In Acts chapter 20, verse 35, when Paul is speaking to the elders of the church from Ephesus, whom he's met at Miletus, he tells them they ought to be working in order to help those who are in need, remembering the words of the Lord, how he said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." So these are the words of Jesus, and the fact that they are the words of Jesus means that they're not words that you can dismiss or pass over or treat lightly. But where are they found? I wonder, can you quote me the reference for those words? Can you tell me when and how which Jesus said that? It is more blessed to give than to receive. As a matter of fact, you can't. You won't find the words in the gospel narratives. This is the only place you'll find them, in Acts chapter 20, and we're indebted to the Apostle Paul for the knowledge of the fact that Jesus said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." I suppose you'd have to say, it's one of those sayings of Jesus, one of those events in the life of Jesus, to which John refers in the very last verse of his Gospel, when he says, there are many other things that Jesus did, and presumably said, which are not written in this book, and John goes on to say that if everything that Jesus did were to be recorded, I suppose the books of the whole world would not be able to contain it. And by the way, speaking of Paul being the one to remind us, and incidentally, it's evident that the elders knew about this statement, because he says, remembering the words of the Lord Jesus. Do you know that you're indebted to the Apostle Paul also for the fact that Jesus, in the night in which he was betrayed, broke bread and instituted the supper that we've just celebrated? Do you know that in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, that is the first recorded notion that we have of the institution of the Lord's Supper? It predates Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Paul is the one first to tell you that Jesus instituted the supper and said, "Do this in remembrance of me." However, let's get back to the text. You think about that statement, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." And think about it, because it cuts across received wisdom. It cuts across everything that's commonly believed in the world. Forget the fact that the words are quoted flippantly, so frequent as I've just told you. The reality is that those words are revolutionary. And if we're not moved by them, if we're not startled by them, it's either because we've worn the cutting edge from them, or we just don't believe what Jesus says. It is more blessed to give than to receive. What's he saying? What's he doing here? What does he mean? Well, Jesus is actually drawing a picture, a contrast, between two different philosophies of life. He's talking about two different characters. He's talking about the giver and the getter. Now, there's nothing new in that, of course, is there? Because Jesus constantly divided people up into groups like that. The wheat and the tares, the sheep and the goats, the wise and the foolish, those on the broad way, those on the narrow way, and so on. Well, here it's the givers and the getters. Now, let us understand this. Jesus is not saying that some people do nothing but give and others do nothing but get, because that isn't true. We're all givers and getters to a larger or lesser degree in our lives. What the Lord is really saying is that there are some people whose predominant aim in life is to get, and there are others who love nothing better than to give. And that was true even among the 12 when he chose them. Those men whom he chose to be his apostles. Think about Judas, for example. Now, in spite of what Judas did, Judas was not a monster. He wasn't altogether bad. There must have been something about Judas which caused Jesus to choose him in the first place. And it's rather simplistic to suggest that Jesus chose him in order to fulfill prophecy. No. There must have been something in Judas which Jesus saw, some possibility. And by the same token, you have to say that there must have been something in Jesus which attracted Judas. Because men who are totally bad are never attracted to people who are totally good. The trouble with Judas was, as you very well know, that he had a weak spot, and that weak spot was his covetousness. Judas was a getter. And you see that in the question that he placed before the rulers of the Jews. He said, "What will you give me if I deliver him to you? What will you give me?" Now, in contrast, you look at Peter. Oh, we know about Peter's weaknesses. We've talked about Peter's weaknesses. He wasn't perfect by any means. But you see Peter and John going up to the temple to pray in Acts chapter 3 after the day of Pentecost. And there's the man at the beautiful gate of the temple, the man there at the temple gate rather, and he's begging. And Peter puts his hand into his pocket and he comes up with nothing. Nothing. But he says, "Silver and gold I do not have, but such as I have I give you. I don't have silver and gold, but what I have I will give." Here's the difference. Judas says, "What will you give me, and I will deliver him to you." Peter says, "I don't have money, but what I have I give." So, what does Jesus mean when he says it's more blessed to give than to receive? And let's be careful not to make the statement more difficult than it already is. I think Jesus is making two assertions. The first is implied. I think Jesus is implying, first of all, that it is blessed to receive. It is blessed to receive. The comparison is, it is more blessed to give. But he's implying that it is blessed to receive, and I don't think anybody will disagree with that. Don't you believe it's happy to receive? I use the word happy because the word makarios, blessed, means happy. I always smile when I think of that word happy, makarios, because I think of that Archbishop of Crete who was named Archbishop Makarios, and invariably I think of the Seven Dwarfs. Happy there. Well, he was makarios too. Now, of course, we've been receivers all of our lives, haven't we? From our very earliest days, from the moment we became aware of anything, we have been receivers and happy to receive. As I say, much of the world is, the Western world at any rate, is preparing to celebrate Christmas today. And whatever you make of Christmas as a religious festival, the fact remains that as a holiday, what makes Christmas a happy memory for the vast majority of people is that this is a time of receiving. Well, think about your early days as a child. Think about when you first thought about or considered Christmas. Do you remember those days? Do you ever speak to your friend and say, "What are you getting for Christmas?" And did you never ask yourself, "What am I getting for Christmas?" Now, in those early days, as a child, you didn't think too much about the giving side. You weren't on the giving side then. You were on the getting side. And that preoccupied your mind, didn't it? I still believe in Santa Claus. I still believe in Santa Claus. And I think you do too. I'm firmly convinced that it is blessed to receive. And I suspect that you have not grown away from that philosophy either. Mind you, it's not always good that we love to receive, that we have this desire to receive. Not always wise either. It's this love of receiving that makes us pray to tricksters who persuade us that they're giving us a bargain. It's this love of receiving that helps us to buy books from people like Reader's Digest because they tell us we're going to get 6 numbers that will give us an opportunity of winning a vast fortune. It's this love of receiving that makes us pray to politicians, who tell us they're going to give us something. And while it's a great thing to get something for nothing from anybody, in the minds of some people, to receive something for nothing from the government is almost paradise itself. And then there are those higher values, the more important values that we've received and that have been blessings to us. You know, let me be personal. Isabel and I have done a lot of receiving since we came here 6 or 7 months ago. The kindness and the love and the concern has been tangible, and I really mean tangible, not just felt, not just sensed, but it's been a reality, and we're so grateful for the love that's been shown to us. There are those blessings of encouragement and strength and comfort and appreciation and sympathy. And how much do you owe to the people who took an interest in you when other people were not concerned about you? How much do you owe to those people who gave you back your self-respect and your self-confidence when you'd lost it almost? These are the important things of life. And then there are the joys of receiving from God Himself, the higher joys. I think of the time when God said to Abraham, I believe it's Genesis 22, He said, I will bless you. That's a wonderful thing, isn't it? To receive God's blessing. I hope you receive God's blessing by being here today. That's one of the reasons for coming together, that we might receive God's blessing in our worship. And from that point of view, I'm personally thankful that under God, somebody was sufficiently interested in preaching the gospel in a way that a 14-year-old boy could understand and obey it a long time ago. But you know, fine as it is to hear God say, I will bless you, what followed in His word to Abraham is even more important. God said, and be thou a blessing. You will be a blessing. So, while it's good to receive a blessing, it's even better to be a blessing. And that's what Jesus meant when He said it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's better to be a blessing than to receive a blessing. And that second statement, more blessed to give than to receive. Why is it more blessed to give than it is to receive? Yes, I say we accept that it's a blessing to receive, but why is it more of a blessing to give than to receive? Well, this is not going to be a sermon on giving, by the way. You can forget that. At least not in the usual format, you know. Our giving must be personal, it must be proportionate, it must be... and so we go on down the list, you know, and we tick them off, personal, proportionate, purpose, cheerful. No, I don't want to do that. The trouble is sometimes a sermon like that almost becomes like an interview with a taxman, you know. And it becomes an almost mathematical calculation based upon an economic necessity. Well, you know, we've got to pay the preacher's salary, we've got to pay the office staff, and we've got to pay the utilities, and we need this and that, and we need... And that's how we view our giving sometimes. I don't want to do that. I want to talk about what I would call the philosophical view of giving, the reason why giving is important to us, not just important to the congregation as a congregation, not even just important as an act of worship. But I want to suggest that only by giving do we justify our right to exist. Only by giving do we justify our right to exist. Only by giving do we give real meaning to our getting. And only when we give are we capable of receiving. Very briefly, because my voice is really going. Think of the first point I want to make. Only by giving do we justify our right to exist. Now think seriously about this. George Bernard Shaw once said that a gentleman is one who puts more into life than he takes out. Consider that. A gentleman is one who puts more into life than he takes out. What he's saying is that what really matters in life is service. There is in the Greek fables the story of Achilles, who became a warrior, as you know. When Achilles was born, the oracle is supposed to have told his mother he would either have a long life of idleness or a short life of service. And protective as mothers usually are, she sent him to the island of Scyros, which was populated only by women, in the hope that he might be safe there and live a long life. Well, that's where he grew up. He dressed in girls' clothes. As a young man, he dressed as a young woman. And we're talking about Achilles here. Well, the Greeks went to war with Troy. And the oracle said again, the Greeks could only win if Achilles led them into battle. And so Ulysses was sent out to look for this elusive young man. Eventually he located him on the island of Scyros, but he didn't quite know who he was. As I say, Achilles was dressed as a young girl. And so Ulysses took a basket with him and went as a peddler, with trinkets and ribbons and bows and ornaments of all kinds. He went onto the island, and the women flocked around him, delighted at what they saw in the basket, and they took virtually all his wares away from him. But one young woman stood aloof, stood aside. When all the rest had gone, Ulysses took a cloth from the basket and revealed in the basket a suit of shining armor and a sword, and that young woman's eyes lit up, and Ulysses knew that he had discovered Achilles, and Achilles led the Greeks in a successful war against the Trojans. Now that's the Greek story, but here's the idea. Life is service. We only give real meaning to our lives when we give in service. After all, the Son of Man, Jesus says, came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. The second point here then, only by giving can we give real meaning to our getting. Now, we live in a world today in which many people live simply to amass a great fortune. And such people are not great people, even though the world may regard them as great people. I'm thinking of two men at the moment. One man who lived 200 years ago. One man who died in our British economy not very many years ago. His name was Robert Maxwell. I don't know if the news ever got to the United States. Robert Maxwell was a very great financier. But unfortunately, the Maxwell Empire, and it was very, very vast, he hobnobbed with royalty, with all the great people of the world. But unfortunately, he took the retirement money of hundreds of thousands of people, and he lost it. And then eventually he ended up a suicide on a yacht somewhere in the Mediterranean. And the name of Robert Maxwell is mentioned with disgust and shame by so many people in the United Kingdom today. He's actually buried, I'll tell you this, he's actually buried on the slopes of the Mount of Olives in a Jewish cemetery, buried there by some people who somehow managed to profit from this man's misdemeanors. The other man, not a rich man, but a man who mended shoes. We call him a cobbler in England, a shoe mender. But on his wall he had a map of the world, marked with the place where he wanted to see the gospel of Christ preached. That man also saved, but he saved to give. That man eventually went to India, became the first missionary to India in modern times in the 1700s, and his name is remembered with affection and reverence wherever it is mentioned today. His name is William Carey, the first missionary to India in the age of modern missions. Actually, William Carey came from not very far from Corby, where we used to live. He walked 6 miles to be buried, to be baptized in the River Nen under the shadow of Northampton Castle. He was a baptized believer. But he went to India. Spent 50 years in India. His wife died there. Even when she was sick, he didn't come home with his wife. She died in India. She's buried in India too. He is buried there also. But he translated the scriptures into scores of Indian dialects. And over his grave today, there is a very simple memorial. It says, "Here lies the body of William Carey, who for 50 years mended shoes to the glory of God." That's moving. Not William Carey, the great missionary, the great translator of the scripture, the man who dedicated his life to mission work. But what a difference in these two men. One got to keep and lost everything and will be remembered with shame. The other got to give and will be remembered with honor wherever his name is mentioned. A last thought, because the time has gone, and I'm trying to make it as short as I can today. You know, receiving without giving can be a positive curse. Some of you have been to the Holy Land. You may have seen the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is the lowest inhabited spot on earth. It's about 1,350 or 60 feet below sea level. But nothing lives in the Dead Sea. Do you know why? It has no known outlet. It receives the River Jordan. The River Jordan begins in the snows of Mount Hermon in the north, and there is always snow on Mount Hermon. And it flows down in that river. The word Jordan means the descender, because it comes down with such tremendous speed, such tremendous force through the Jordan Valley, leaving behind a trail of fertility and fruitfulness and flowers. But it ends in the Dead Sea, along with 5 or 6 other streams, most of which come from the Jordanian side. But the water doesn't leave. The only reason the level is maintained is by evaporation. And consequently, it has a very high salt content. It has a 26% salt content. That's why you can float in the Dead Sea. But nothing lives there. There's no life there. That's why it's dead. It receives, but it doesn't give. And so with us, we must remember that if we receive but do not give, we die. And there are many, many people in the world today who are constantly receiving, but because they do not give, their lives are fruitless and useless. There's a song about this in the songbook. I don't know if we know it here. I think it's number 556. It draws a picture of that stream that comes down from Hermon, the River Jordan, and it speaks of the fertility and the fruitfulness and the life it gives to the land. And then it speaks of the sea which is dead. And if you look at verse 3, it says, "Which shall it be for you and me who God's good gifts obtain? Shall we accept for self alone, or take to give again? For he who once was rich indeed laid all his glory down, that by his grace our ransomed race should share his wealth and crown." One final text, and then the message is yours. The statement of Jesus recorded in the Gospels that comes closest to what I've been telling you this morning is found there in Luke chapter 6, verse 38. Jesus himself said, "Give, and it shall be given unto you. Pressed down, shaken together, running over, shall men give into your bosom. For with what measure you meet, it shall be meted to you again." The greatest gift that Jesus gave is the gift of salvation, the gift of life. If you're present this morning and you still have not yielded your life in obedience to Jesus, maybe this is the time when you need to consider the things you've heard so often and the things you know so well and make your decision to follow Jesus. And if you've been a Christian and you have not been faithful and you need restoration to the family of God and the prayers of your brethren, maybe this is the day for you to respond in a way that will delight the heart of God and the hearts of God's people. And stand and come forward as we stand to sing the song. Let's stand to sing.